Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Today's guest is Kaiser Health News Editor-in-Chief, author, and New York Times reporter, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. I am enormously excited to introduce our guest today. She is a legend in healthcare. She is an emergency medicine physician, the Editor-in-Chief of Kaiser Health News, a former New York Times reporter, and the author of one of my favorite books in healthcare, probably one of the most impactful books, honestly, of our generation in healthcare, An American Sickness. Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, what a privilege to have you on the podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I love the introduction, and thank you. I'm glad the book influenced some young physicians, and hope it will change our healthcare system. That was the whole goal of writing it.
Yeah, well I do want to say, actually, before we start, that if you have not read this book, if you do not know about this book, just go read it. It is an extremely important read. To understand how medicine works, how the dysfunctional system works. I think it should be required reading for every medical student in this country. And I mean, I'm not saying every word should be taken as gospel, and hopefully, Elizabeth, you won't fault me for saying that, but it's a very important read. And I'm not getting any kickbacks for saying that. So just want to pause there and emphasize that.
I mean, you know, the book is not, it challenges every part of our healthcare system. Yeah. To be better and to be different, because when I trained as a doctor, it wasn't this way. And it's now become this kind of Rube Goldberg-like machine where every sector, every part of the healthcare system is driven more by the finance and less by health and care. And that bothers me.
Yeah. I was honestly one of the, understanding that Rube Goldberg machine was a key reason I went to business school, and I think a lot of people are just absolutely starving for information to try to figure this out, and just sort of feel like they're being whipped around in it. Yeah. But before going into the book, and I will, I wanted to actually start with some introspection into your background, if you don't mind. So you studied history and biology at Stanford. You then got a master's in English from the University of Cambridge as a Marshall Scholar. And then you got your medical degree from Harvard and practice part-time as an emergency medicine physician after completing your residency at Cornell. And then ultimately you became a full-time New York Times reporter. My first question is, how did you find your way into medicine and then ultimately into your career as a journalist and writer? And you should feel free to answer that however you like.
Sure. It's not a very coherent path, but I come from a family of physicians. My dad and his twin brother were both went to Columbia PNS and then trained at NYU. And all the women of my generation are many of them are physicians. So it was kind of the natural thing to do if you didn't know what you wanted to do. And I liked it. You know, it wasn't like it was thoughtless. I enjoyed medicine. I still think is I always want to do something meaningful that I can have a tangible impact on someone's life. And, you know, medicine, and particularly I trained in internal medicine, but worked in an emergency department. And there's nothing more satisfying than seeing a patient who has a problem, you know, sewing up a cut or doing something really tangible. And I like that. I also loved writing. And, but I, you know, it wasn't like I worked on the Stanford Daily. It was part of my high school newspaper. I wasn't. When I got the Marshall, I went over to England to do at Cambridge the history of science, and discovered once I was there that it was only actually a 1-year course, and the scholarship was for 2 years. So I had to pick something different. So I did English and English literature, and you know, kind of got more in touch with the writing side of me. And then it was a very long course through medical school because I was really more torn once I started enjoying writing. And I had done a little freelancing in England for United Press. So at some point I delayed medical school a year, then Harvard basically said, you come now or you come never. So I went for a year. And then I took off a year and worked as a journalist at a not very good science magazine in New York City called Science Digest, where I kind of got the journalism bug and I really enjoyed it. But again, at the end of that year, Harvard said, like, okay, you come back now or you never come back. And I was like, okay, I'm not quite sure. And I really like medicine. So from there, though, from that point on, I was doing both writing on the side and medicine. So, you know, fourth year of medical school, you have extra time to write. My internship year, I didn't. But after that, my second and third years of residency, I wrote a column for Discover magazine just about medicine and what I was doing. And it just kind of took off from there. And I chose to go into the emergency room because, A, I like that kind of, you know, I'm an adrenaline person. I like that. Mm-hmm. And also full time in the emergency room meant 3 days a week and I could write those other 2 days. So I was doing a lot of freelancing. And then now I'm going to sound like a real dinosaur. I was happily working in the emergency room and doing freelancing for the New York Times when there was something called the Clinton Health Reform Plan that came along. Mm-hmm. And they said, do you want to come here and cover that full time? And I honestly thought, yeah, I'll do that and it will pass. And then I'll go back to being a physician. And, you know, of course, it didn't pass. And I kind of got the journalism bug. And New York Presbyterian, where I was working, said if you wanted to work in the emergency room, you had to get ER boarded. So I would have had to go back to the other stuff. And so it was a real kind of life happens story. And then my then husband and I got offered jobs covering the New York Times, China for the New York Times. So I kind of washed my hands of trying to figure out US healthcare and covered China. It was based in Beijing for 6 years, where, you know, ironically, my best stories were about bird flu, SARS, and the HIV/AIDS crisis in rural China. So, you know, it was kind of a long road. And ultimately, I felt like I could make more of a difference to some of the problems I'd seen in the emergency room, even then in the early 1990s, by writing about them than by dealing with them one at a time, because a lot of them, even then, were system problems. You know, mm-hmm. how do you treat a person who's poor or underinsured? I mean, at the time, people like you and me who had decent commercial insurance, you know, the premiums, mostly your employer paid. There weren't deductibles and co-pays or co-insurance or any of that junk. But still, you know, I was working in an urban ER and there were many problems you would deal with, which really weren't medical problems. They were social. Right.
When you were a medical student and in the years following before you went to China, were you exclusively writing about healthcare topics?
You mean before I went to China or?
Yeah, before you went to China.
Yeah, because I think, you know, there are two ways into journalism, really. One is, you know, now there are all these different social media ways and, you know, new web-based sites. But at the time, mm-hmm. you know, you did your 5 years at a local newspaper and then you went to a bigger newspaper. So I would joke that like my internship was like my 5 years at the Jersey Journal. I mean, mm-hmm. you could go in as a specialist. And you know, your knowledge added value. And I kind of had to learn the craft of journalism by doing a lot of freelancing. And during, you know, the Times took a risk with me. And during my first months there, my stories weren't optimal, you know, but I learned. And, you know, so a lot of people will say to me, if they're physicians who love writing, like, how do I do this? And it's like anything, you just start writing. And you write. I wrote for anyone and everyone to begin with. You know, a lot of people are like, I'm going to write for the New York Times. And I was like, yeah, I wrote for women's magazines. I wrote for, you know, kind of Discover. I wrote for the Times travel section. I would write for anyone because I was learning and I knew I had to learn.
What was it like working for the New York Times? Could you comment on what it means to have that journalism bug? What were you itching for? Or what scratch were you itching?
You know, daily journalism has the same kind of adrenaline rush as ER medicine. Huh. And there are many of the same skills involved. You know, people would always say, well, that's a weird transition from the emergency room to becoming a journalist. But in fact, you know, the skill that was really relevant that I took away from medical school and from the ER is I could walk into a room with any person in the world and ask them the most embarrassing questions. And I never felt uncomfortable with it. So, yeah. You know, so that interviewing skill in medicine, when not asking leading questions and listening to, you know, symptoms or someone's story is just critical, I think, to both pursuits and both. And I think the reason there are a lot of doctor writers is because, you know, many people who go into medicine, they're really interested in the human condition. And, you know, there is a lot of overlap there. In fact, from my class in medical school, there's Perry Class, who's a wonderful writer, Ethan Kanan, who became a novelist and then went back and completed his degree because he wanted to practice too. There are a whole bunch of writers. So I think it's kind of, there are natural synergies, but of course there are many other things that people do with medicine these days. And, you know, at the time, really when I left medicine for good, it was more, it happened to me than I always thought I would go back. But after 6 years in China, I realized if I were in the emergency room, I wouldn't want me as my doctor. And that was a bad place to be. And I saw, you know, honestly, when the Clinton health reform effort failed, I was kind of despondent, as I kind of am now, about like healthcare in the US, even though it wasn't nearly as bad as it is today, you know, now.
Right.
And so I went to China to do something different. And then I actually spent 6 years after that covering health and environment in Europe with really focus on climate change and environment, because I thought, well, this is an issue where I can, you know, maybe make a difference. And then at some point, you know, if you train as a doctor, that's what you know about, right? And so the Times at some point said, you know, we need you. It was the beginning of the ACA and covering. Mm-hmm. They said, we really need you back in New York to cover the ACA. And I said, I've done one of these health reform things before and it ended badly. I just want to do a series on why the American healthcare system costs so much. Mm-hmm. And Dean Becquet, who was then the managing editor, said, okay. And that became a series called Pain Till It Hurts, which ran for 2 years and won a whole bunch of prizes, which basically led to the book, An American Sickness, because after that series, I realized that there had developed this crazy, crazy health system, but I didn't understand why or how, and I really wanted to go deeper.
How many years did that take? Like the depth and complexity of that book seems incredibly daunting.
Well, because I'd spent 2 years working on that series, and in the series, it was probably about 12 major stories, and it looked at all the ordinary things in American medicine that have gotten so damn expensive in the last two decades, in my lifetime, you know. And so it looked at the first one, which, you know, to the horror of the New York Times photo desk, was about screening colonoscopies. They were like, are we going to illustrate this? And I'm like, not my problem, you know, but I don't know. I don't know why my screening colonoscopy, because I had just turned 50, was, you know, billed at $13,000. And my insurer said, great news, we bargained on your behalf and only paid $9,500. So, you know, we did all the ordinary procedures and just why they cost. We looked at how much they cost and what were the components of the cost. But, you know, newspaper stories only go to a certain depth. And I knew, for example, when it comes to colonoscopies and that 13,000 one that I so enjoyed with the propofol added, what the majority, the biggest single charge was for a facility fee, right? Mm-hmm. And I knew when I called as a reporter to physicians in Europe and said, well, what's the facility fee for a colonoscopy? There would be like this weird silence at the other end of the phone. You know, well, what's that? You know, why, you can't do a colonoscopy without a room. And so then I got interested in, well, how did we get this thing called a facility fee that right. is unique to American medicine? And so I had a lot of material from the series, a lot of patients who'd sent me their stories that I just felt like I needed to get to the next level. And I really, you know, owe a tremendous debt to all the people who wrote in about that series who said, this is what happened at my hospital, and this is how we got this crazy thing like a facility fee, including some, you know, with your business background, some people, one young woman who'd worked as a consultant for one of the big consulting firms and described what they did when they went into hospitals and said, not like, you know, we're going to tell you how to take better care of patients more efficiently, but we're going to tell you how you can do that exact same thing and just bill a whole lot more for it. Like, yeah. Why are you leaving all this money on the table? Why are you giving away the room for free? And why aren't you charging every time you put up by the, you know, in 15 minute intervals for recovery room time? Now, the medical answer is, half the reason people sit in the recovery room is because the surgeons are at dinner or the bed's not ready, not because they need to be in the recovery room. But now most recovery rooms, which when I was practicing medicine, were not charged as anything. They just weren't a charge. You know, now they're charged by the minute. When I worked as an ER doctor, I just came with the room. You know, that yeah. doesn't happen anymore. So, you know, a lot of the innovation that's happened in healthcare has been around billing and business models that that make the billing and the money on the front burner and the healthcare on the back burner. So I kind of, my goal is to kind of reverse that, not to say, you know, it is a business. It has to be a business. It has to be sustainable, whether people have to be making as much money off of it as they do now, I would probably take issue with, but it's not inherently the business or the profit that bothers me. It's the greed in the profit and the degree to which that drives the system.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have the economic rules of a dysfunctional medical market in your book. And yeah. one of them that really struck with me, which seems, I don't know,
they're all awful.
So they're all crazy. I know. Which is one of them was like, there are no standards for billing. There's money to be made in billing for anything and everything. You know, bill whatever you can get away with.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, when it comes to medicine, you know, it becomes the old, there's no price you can put on your health. And that's
right.
kind of what drives this.
Right. Well, you know, okay. So one of the questions I think I'd mentioned I want to ask was, the provocative question of, do you think your book or your work is anti-business? Because I would argue that it's actually to continue the status quo that would be anti-business, because if you believe in a capitalist type of system or like a functional system where right. markets function, you want there to be functional markets, not dysfunctional markets. I don't know how you've been thinking about that. Or even like ask this way, is like, do you think that if like Mitch McConnell read your book, he would scoff at it or be like, and I actually see it from a different lens of like, this is actually not a partisan thing. This is just trying to fix the gums of the system.
Yeah. And I, you know, I, now that I live in DC with KHN, Kaiser Health News, I get called into Congress by, you know, people from both sides of the aisle. I think healthcare has become first a pocketbook issue for many Americans, not even about like, am I getting good care? It's like, can I afford anything? And how, you know, what are the trade-offs involved in that? And, you know, I started in medicine at a time when Yeah, it was ridiculously inefficient and things were badly run. So it was not bad to have a little bit, someone in there with a clipboard going like, why is the X-ray machine, 3 miles from the ER? That's not a good thing. I mean, there were a lot of inefficiencies. And when consolidation, which has now gone haywire, started, it was with good intent. Every hospital doesn't need to do everything. But again, it kind of what started with the best of intentions, it's, that road to hell is paved in good intentions, kind of got co-opted. And I think high prices on pharmaceuticals do drive in innovation, but I kind of joke, well, like, doesn't a Nobel Prize mean anything or doing good mean anything? Like, what degree of profit do you need to drive innovation? Especially since now what we see is many drugs that are not even innovative, that are just
Right.
really expensive. They're just copies because if what you care about is making money, it's much easier to copy a drug that already exists and sell it for a high price than to truly innovate. So all these things that started off making sense no longer do in this market, which
Yeah.
is highly dysfunctional. And I guess the underlying question is, we've been turning somersaults for 25 years to set up what we call, the right incentives for people to
Right.
do good. And we fail, we haven't found them. I mean, there's some, there's bundled payments, which have kind of worked to a degree. There's accountable care organizations, which have worked to a degree. There's certificate of need programs, which have worked to a degree. And but none of them have really, they all end up work like the 340B program, which we just did a TV slot on, amazingly enough, at Kaiser Health News, which was supposed to help poor and underserved hospitals get expensive medicines to their patients, has been totally hijacked by, wealthier hospitals who want those rates for patients, for all patients. So, every good program we've tried to help the market behave better has been kind of hijacked by those who just see it as a business opportunity. And that's tragic. And it's mostly not the physicians who are doing that, but much of medicine is driven by business people who really don't have that background. So
Do you think that the trouble is that you need to have, talking from a place of bias here, and I'm completely humble in my background. I'm just curious if the answer is in part having a person who understands the game and sees both sides of the business side, if you will, and the clinical side, to be sitting at the table and creating those incentive systems so that the gamesmanship is accounted for, or do we need to just scrap the system altogether and go to like a single payer system?
Well, first of all,
That's a loaded question, I recognize.
as a journalist, I could not say, if I want to remain a journalist, yes, we should go to a single payer system. And I honestly don't think it's the only answer. I don't think it is likely the United States's answer because just culturally it feels off, but not because I think it wouldn't work,
Sure.
I'm always though somewhat amused when I moderate panels of economists who range from liberal to conservative, and they all have these ideas about how we're going to, create incentives to make medicine do the right thing for patients. And at the end, I asked one of them at a panel, or four of them at a panel, so do you really think you could do this without some kind of price setting? And they're all like, no, of course not. So I do wonder if, and I think this is tragic actually for the well-intentioned people who are trying to make the system work better, that I think a lot of the people who are pure business in our system have overplayed their hand now and people are fed up. So if it keeps spooling out this way, I could see price setting happening. And we're seeing, you know, the little inklings of Medicare drug price negotiation.
Right.
If there'd been some self-restraint within the industry, I don't think we'd be there. But, and I think what's been proposed is kind of like a little bit lame, but, you know, it's well-deserved because, you know, we're paying crazy amounts and people can't afford their medicines unless they get copay coupons, which are kind of bribes so that, you know, the drug makers can charge the insurers crazy amounts. And, you know, I'm angry about this even today as I hear, you know, our government is now, well, we're going to require that insurers pay for rapid COVID antigen.
Right, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, why don't, you know, why don't we just make them cheap or free? Why do you want insurance? You know, this is just going to be another kind of scam where our, you know, people will go, well, why are my premiums going up? Well, it's because your insurer paid, you know, crazy amounts of money for tests that cost 50 cents in the rest of the world and are over the counter. So it's kind of the whole way we've come to think about things is highly inflationary and leads exactly to where we are today.
A big philosophical question, actually, around this topic. Do you think that the reason we are here has to do with the fact that we are a wealthy country with an employer-based healthcare system that was incomplete and things have just sort of been tacked on? Like, do you think that if, unlike other developed nations where their healthcare costs aren't nearly as high, that this is just a result of the system we have, or is it just a coincidence that we just happen to have, like, if we had to really ask, like, the root cause, why did we get here? Have you ever wondered about that? Or is this just a natural progression of what happens when a wealthy nation tries to provide healthcare to its recipients and can afford to pay, you know, there's no price on healthcare, so we're just going to keep inflating it?
Well, I think it's partly that we approach it as a commodity rather than a public good, right? So every other country, there really isn't any other country that doesn't have some kind of mechanism for controlling prices. So, you know, we believe in the free market and we pretend that this is, you know, a market at work. But of course, you know, even with the best incentives, you can't, you just can't choose things in healthcare. Even, and I think price transparency is great. You know, I think it should be on hospital walls. But, you know, like when my kid went into an emergency room with belly pain sent there annoyingly by her university's health service for a stomach ache, and the ER doctor, you know, when she was 19, said, we're going to get a sono, and that was $12,000, and a CAT scan, and that was $18,000. Who had a choice there? You know, how can you, you can't be a good consumer in the current system. Right. So, and I think there's a, you know, being a consumer in healthcare, I think everyone should be for simple things like tests and radiology, things that are non-emergent. But so I think knowing prices is great. I wish physicians knew the prices of the things they ordered because mostly they're blind to them. So they're as shocked as anyone else when the bill comes back at $18,000. But I think, you know, thinking of healthcare as just another market is highly problematic inherently.
Maybe one thing we could do on this podcast, given our audience are often clinical trainees, is maybe highlight, is there anything you think that could be done in the educational level or people can do as they're going through medical school and residency to serve their patients better and then make a difference in whatever job they end up taking afterwards? Like one thing that I was curious about is as a primary care doctor, should I be during like my annual Medicare visits where I do advanced care directives and MiniCOG also like walk through the different insurance options with my patient and explain it to them? Because it requires like idiosyncratic understanding of them specifically. Any reflections on that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think the ACA was a great thing, but the fact that you needed, like, you know, tens of thousands of navigators because the choices were so damn complicated,
right,
is inherently a problem. So no, I don't think you as a, first of all, it would take way longer than the actual visit to explain the options. You know, it's, you know, people choosing marketplace plans often have to sit down for 45 minutes with the navigator to just, which I think is nuts. You know, that means we haven't designed a very good system, or it's so complicated that literally no one understands it. But I think there are things, you know, I think one thing that's been a little sad to me is that most, and I'm encouraged by people, of physicians of your generation, that a lot of doctors in my generation and, you know, they kind of, I wouldn't say that they enabled this, but they were very passive as it was happening. You know, they were like, ooh, this is bad. I hate that I'm being, you know, compensated according to how many RVUs I bill. I hate that, you know, these business people are telling me I should be billing more level four visits, that it's, you know, it's bad for revenue cycle management to bill things. Mm-hmm. But they felt helpless against this kind of force that was happening. And I kept saying, like, you are the people who bring the patients to the hospital. Without the physicians bringing mm-hmm. them in, you know, they can't do anything. And so I really, you know, and it's hard. And your generation is starting to be much more vocal about when they see something they don't like, saying something. Now, of course, that's really hard when you're a resident, because are you going to challenge, you know, your employer and say, you know, why are we billing $18,000?
I feel like you're in a great position to do that. They can't fire you as a resident and you're salaried yeah. and they can't do anything.
Yeah, but they can't offer you, they won't offer you a job. They'll encourage you to go elsewhere for your practice. But
That's true, I guess.
You know, I do, and I'm frequently invited to speak at medical schools, at academic centers. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, the development people from the hospitals are like, oh, we want to take you on a tour of the new hospital. And like, look, it's all private rooms. And aren't the sculptures great? And look, there's a great restaurant in the lobby. And you can see the academic or the medical school people just like, you know, like they're so embarrassed. And I'm thinking, you know, this is a beautiful building. I hope you have plans to make it into condos, because this is not of healthcare.
Have you seen Stanford's new hospital?
I haven't, but I've seen like the new med. I saw many years later, like the.
It is a resort. I am dumbfounded every time. It's so beautiful. But anyway, sorry. I'm just hoping that that's like fancy tech money that finances that.
Yeah. And I remember like the big issue when I was there is like they built a new hospital and, you know, somehow it didn't end up the right level. And so to get from the old hospital to the new hospital, they couldn't get stretchers up the ramp, which, you know, the old fashioned kind of problem. So, you know, I think what you can do, and what I think would be really useful, is ask, you know, on order sheets, ask that the price, like ask what the hospital charges, you know, what's the charge master price for each of those things? So when you're ordering them, you can at least as the physician be a good custodian of your patient's hard-earned dollars. So if you see that they're charging, you know, $18,000 for a CAT scan, and you know, all you really want is for a patient to get it, you know, the following week, just to rule out something, you know, but hospitals are very resistant to that, because they know if a doctor saw, you know, we're charging $870 for a vitamin D test, most physicians would go, it's not worth that, you know?
You say in your book, it's like reinforce the separation between the business side and the medical side. I don't think residents have any idea how billing or any of this system works.
So I wish there was more education on that. I wish, you know, I've seen at some hospitals, you know, when I was in medicine, when I was practicing medicine, hospitals were run by doctors. That's not true largely now, or some are physician, you know, business people. But, you know, I think, you know, kind of barge your way into the hospital meetings, get on the board. They should have a student representative to speak up for patients, because I think they're the ones. I mean, it always surprises me, because doctors are the ones in the end who the patient will come back to and say, like, hey, I mean, and this is literally our next bill of the month for NPR. You know, the ACA said that hospitals had to offer charity care or payment plans for people who couldn't afford their care. So, you know, we have a patient who got a payment plan of $45,000 a month for her son's stay in the NICU. Is that really a payment plan? I mean, that's just craziness. Like, you wouldn't take that from your contractor. You wouldn't accept that for your iPhone. You know, it's just, it's bonkers. It's taking business concepts and applying them to situations where they just don't apply. And so, yeah, I think young physicians should speak up a lot more, because you're the ones who see exactly what's happening to the really average patients. You know, as physicians age, their patients age and they get better insured. And, you know, so they don't see some of the on the ground problems, I think, that are occurring.
Curious, I know it's a little bit of a transition to this question. Are you encouraged, or maybe you don't see this as a victory, by how the health system has responded to Biogen's Alzheimer's drug, Aduhelm?
I'm mildly encouraged, but, you know, I'm despondent that something like that gets approved.
If that happens, yeah, that's fair
enough.
You know,
why is that even out there? Is the question, and what are the forces, you know, and why, in a similar vein, as we're approaching the question of, are we going to need an Omicron booster? Why is the first word on that from the CEO of Pfizer and Moderna, you know, and they're kind of priming the market and priming the demand for something that at least most experts I've spoken to think we're not going to need that. But, you know, and I know the NIH has, you know, Dr. Fauci has at different points kind of chasing these guys and said, look, don't do science by press release. But, you know, their customer right. is not you or me. It's their shareholders. And they know
right.
that.
They have a fiduciary duty to right. be that voice.
So I don't blame them for saying it. I kind of blame sure. us for not, well, I do blame them for saying it, but you know, that's why I'm not in that world. But, you know, I think we've allowed drug advertising, pharmaceutical advertising on TV. It's hard, as a First Amendment right, it's hard to say, you know,
right.
Dr. Bourla can't get up and say whatever he wants about the Pfizer vaccine.
What would you say to somebody who says, Elizabeth, this is all great, you know, you bring up good points, but this is naive. Like, this is how, you know, the system works. Hospitals have to make sure that they don't go bankrupt. Moderna needs to make sure that it can continue to innovate and build on its platform. And it's created all these, rapid pace of vaccine development and so forth. And, you know, residents, as soon as they become attendings, they'll come to realize that the system doesn't work the way, like, the desires have to confront, like, the harsh realities of how the system works. How do you confront that cynicism, or even like the entrenched forces that exist within the healthcare system that pay salaries of people once they're no longer once they're outside of training?
Well, I guess what you're asking is if I'm being naive about the possibility of reform, and that a lot of the problems are very hardwired into the system now. And, you know, P.S. Moderna does happen to be in a lawsuit with the NIH about who owns
right.
the patent to the vaccine. So, you know, I think the amount of money that both hospitals, drug companies, PBMs spend on lawsuits is crazy, you know, defending their financial turf as much as anything else. You know, the amount that hospitals spend defending their not-for-profit status against cities that want them to pay taxes is a little nuts. So, you know, am I naive? I don't think so. Am I hopeful that things are going to change rapidly? No, I think it's going to be incrementally. I do think healthcare reform could be a lot like gay marriage, that it happens in states first. And then, you know, at one point when California was heading towards some kind of, you know, single payer or public option, you know, someone said to me, oh, everyone's going to move to California. And I'm like, no, they're not. Like, the people in Utah are going to say, we want that too. And, you know, what I always like to remind people when they say this could never happen here is, in Canada, before there was a public healthcare system, there wasn't. It was very much like the US. And one province, I think it was Saskatchewan, and one health minister, a guy named Tommy Douglas, just said, this is out of control. And they put in place a provincial health system. And within 10 years, all the other provinces imitated what they were doing. And so I think, you know, is that what will happen here? I think not in the kind of wholesale way it happened in Canada, but I think public options are very much on the table in different states. Some efforts at least, if not drug price regulation, at least drug price inflation. So I think there it's a big ship to turn around at this point. And I think one of the biggest obstacles is almost every congressperson and senator's biggest constituent is their local hospital system, not you or me. And so it is very hard. You find even these, you know, good kind of left-wing senators who support Medicare for all, when it comes to something that's going to hurt their local industry or their local hospital, it's like, oh, not that medical device tax in Minnesota, you know,
right.
We have Medtronic here, you know, they can't. So it's very hard politically. Now that I live in Washington, I understand why things that intellectually a lot of these Congress people know are bad, they just don't want to do. Because it's jobs, you know, basically healthcare in America has become a jobs program as much as healthcare. And that's a genuine problem for many cities if we rationalize the healthcare part of it.
Yeah, that makes a really good point. Like if a third of healthcare is waste, if you cut that out, imagine how many jobs are lost.
Yeah. And, you know, I had this wonderful quote from Catherine Becker, who's the dean of the School of Public Health at or the School of Management at the University of Chicago, when we were thinking about this. And she said, well, you know, when modern agriculture developed and there was like combines and tractors and fertilizers, no one said everyone has to stay farmers because, you know, and that's kind of, could we repurpose some of the healthcare workforce? I mean, because we desperately need a better healthcare workforce for aging and, you know, sustainable aging and people in the last decades of life. So it may not mean job loss so much as intensive retraining as we're doing, you know, to try and move from, you know, fossil fuels to sustainable energy. But that really, really requires people to think outside the box. So that's why I encourage people of your generation to do so.
And yeah, I like that a lot. That is very encouraging. I like that perspective. It's not a destructive, it's a building perspective.
Well, there are many holes in our healthcare system that could be filled.
Yeah.
Right? We just don't have the right financial model to fill them. So, you know, because we've decided we reward certain kinds of healthcare and ignore a lot of other, and, you know, that drives what we do. So, you know, every little hospital wants to have a cardiac cath and, you know, joint replacement. That doesn't make sense. You know, that's nuts, but those are the good revenue streams. And No one wants rehab because, you know, that's a money loser.
For my second last question, I've just out of curiosity. It sounds like this is actually a question that one of my good colleagues who's a primary care physician at UCSF and actually a fellow MD-MBA classmate of mine. He was just curious. His name is Alex Katzberg. His question was around where you might see the high level changes coming from in terms of, do you think it's more likely to come from the business leaders, from Congress, from local state politicians? It sounds like based on your prior comment that maybe most the greatest source of optimism might come from the local state level, but I was wondering if you had any reflections there.
Well, you know, after 5 years in Washington, I'm a little skeptical about Congress and what it is able to do. I've had too many conversations where I'm called in and asked to speak to a senator's staff and about the book, and they'll say, you know, that's great, but can't we develop something about, like, you know, streamlined breast cancer treatment? I'm like, yeah, that's been done, you know. So I think politically the states are more where it happens because state legislators have to answer to these really on the ground issues, like, why is this freestanding ER charging three times as much in my city? Mm-hmm. As you know, whereas the bigger problem of surprise bills and Congress is making efforts to make that better, but, you know, their efforts are kind of convoluted. Like, the easy answer is, I don't know, if I go to an in-network hospital, then everyone who touches me should be paid at the in-network rate. And that's the problem. That should be a problem for the hospitals and the doctors to figure out, not the patients. So, you know, but that kind of logical solution won't work politically. So
people listen to this podcast, go work at, lobby your local politicians, work at the local level.
Legislators really care about these issues and are much more responsive to them, and they can do stuff. You know, I wrote a story just last month about how I had a pretty serious head injury 18 months ago, and I was here in DC, and it was at the very beginning of pandemic, and, you know, I was in the neuro ICU for a day, and then I was but it's fine now. And I was discharged, and it was like, we don't want patients in the hospital. I didn't want to be there, right? It was the very beginning of COVID, and there wasn't good testing even.
Oh boy.
So it was like, find a neurologist, find rehab. And because I live near Hopkins, I was connected to a neurologist at Hopkins, and Maryland is the one state that has hospital rate setting.
That's right.
And so
an article in the New York Times recently on that too.
And so, you know, when people said, oh, you can write about your own bills now, I was like, actually, they've all been totally reasonable because you know, what Maryland has, I don't think could be replicated right now in any other state because it started 50 years ago and it was just a weird, and I often kind of joke, well, the Maryland Hospital Association must not be very powerful. But in fact, they bought into this system. And I think that's the message that people in medicine have to realize, that when you talk about rate setting or you talk about rationalizing prices, in many countries, that's done with genuine medical input. The doctors are at the table. And I think that needs to be the goal, like the doctors stepping in to say, these are reasonable prices. This is a reasonable way to do this procedure. And now many physicians feel helpless. And I think that's, they know it's nuts, but they feel like they don't have the power or the time. And I think in that article I wrote, I required one lumbar puncture out of state, and I went to a different hospital, which I won't name, in another state, which is New York, because that's where I'm from. And, you know, they required that the LP, which I had done as a resident and in at the bedside, they required it be done by interventional radiology
in a
procedure suite. And I'm like, this is nuts. And the doctors are like, this is nuts. But, you know, someone had declared that, you know, I don't know if it you know, it could have been they once had a bad outcome. And so, but you know, it was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous
situation. I'm sure they made way more money as a result too.
Oh, it was tens of thousands rather than hundreds at Hopkins. So, and you know, I'm well insured. So I, you know, did I, and that's the problem. You know, I have great insurance. I'd blown through my deductible long since. And a normal person would go, oh, wow, I dodged a bullet. I could have been, you know, I could have had to pay that $17,000. For me, I was furious, but what could I do? You know, am I going to take a big hospital in New York and say, this is ridiculous?
Yes, because you're Elizabeth Rosenthal. And I wrote the wrong person.
Well, I wrote about it and they they did pressure me at the times to say which hospital. And I was like, you know, I'm not going to, because there are probably, you know, 10 hospitals in 10 of the best hospitals in the country that do the exact same thing. So, you know.
Interesting perspective. Well, you are merciful then. I'm joking, but I like that is obviously.
No, I got great care.
It's nauseating because I see that and it's like, anyway.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I got great care. The physicians there were fabulous. They didn't make this decision. They just felt like, you know, I'm like, can you just put me on the exam table and do it like quietly?
But it's the cost of a car. You know, we'd stop to think about that.
Right. I mean, it's nuts. And P.S., the neurologists were much better at it than interventional radiologists who don't do this very much.
My last question, I'm recognizing your time here. I always end with this. It's a lighthearted one.
Yeah.
Is there anything you came across recently that you found compelling or interesting that you might recommend? Ask this of all of our guests. Just out of curiosity, what if you've a book, an article, a TV show, a song, a movie, anything you might recommend?
Well, I'm a little wonky on healthcare and, you know, there was a documentary and this is a bit self-serving because I was interviewed in it, but people who are much smarter than me were interviewed in it too. It's a documentary called Inhospitable and it's about how hospitals have become business. It focuses on UPMC, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and its longstanding battle with the city of Pittsburgh about whether it's a not-for-profit. And, you know, as in many parts of the country, and now I'm going totally wonky on this. I should have said, I really love West Side Story, but in fact, this is my thing.
I like this. This is better.
Okay. Well, you know, as in many parts of the country, that hospital now is also a major insurer and has a major insurance product that dominates Western Pennsylvania. So the film shows people who live in Pittsburgh having insanely to fly to Florida to get cancer care because, you know, they have some other commercial insurance and the oncologists in Pittsburgh only take the hospital's insurance products. So, I mean, the system. And I know there are all these deals now where like you can fly to Oklahoma and go to the Oklahoma Surgery Center and get a cheaper knee replacement. And I'm like, that's great, but that's insane too. Like why, you know, why if there are good hospitals 2 miles away from me, should I be flying across the country to get something done? That's a sign of a very dysfunctional market. Like when I want to shop for groceries, I don't have to take the train to New York to do it. I can just go around the corner here in DC.
Wow. Inhospitable.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Right. The director is Sandra Alvarez and it premiered at the New York Documentary Film Festival a couple of weeks ago.
Wow. Okay. Super. Well, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, what an enormous privilege to have you on. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you. Good luck and make this system better.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked or didn't like, or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org.